Hi, everyone. I'm Josh Schlossberg, editor of the Biomass Monitor, the nation's leading publication covering the health and environmental impacts of biomass energy. You can subscribe to free monthly issues at thebiomassmonitor.org. Thanks for making it on this month's Biomass Truth Conference call hosted by the Biomass Monitor, where we focus on a particular topic relevant to the health, environmental, and economic impacts of biomass energy, invite guest speakers, and discuss the issue. April's call topic is mining the soil for biomass energy, and we'll be talking to John Rhodes, hydrologist and the principal at Planeta Azul, who has more than 30 years of professional experience evaluating the impacts of logging and road building on forest ecosystems and watersheds. We'll have John speak for about 20 minutes or so, explaining some of the impacts of fuels reduction and biomass energy logging on forest soils and watersheds. Then we'll have the rest of the call for questions, so hold your questions until then. And a reminder that we are recording this call so we can pass the audio to the public. And go ahead and take it away, John.
Okay. Hello, folks. We'll start in, I think most of you know, but just a reminder that soil is one of the absolute keystones in forested ecosystems. It's absolutely essential for plant growth, of course, and tree growth, and also the cycling of nutrients and water in watersheds. Some of the key attributes of soil is its ability to infiltrate water, to store that water, and to provide nutrients, not only to plants, but at the watershed scale. These attributes of soils affect water quality, because if the water can't infiltrate, it runs over the surface, it picks up debris, it picks up soils, it causes soil erosion, it causes turbidity that can foul streams. Water quantity, both on site, the more the soil can store water, the more of it is left there to be supplied to plants and also to be released to streams during dry seasons. It's absolutely key for the generation of stream flow during dry seasons. And, of course, soil productivity and plant growth. So those are physical attributes: water infiltration, storage, its ability to store it, nutrients, organic matter, which is supplied when trees and shrubs and vegetation decomposes, is also absolutely essential. It influences water infiltration. The more organic matter you have, the more water infiltration generally you have. It's absolutely critical to the storage of water. Organic matter can store about 90% of its weight in water. That's hundreds of times more than mineral soil without organic matter. And this has all been known for many decades, and it's just critically important. So when we think about organic matter, we'll be talking about that. Logging impacts, when you look at what it does, is you have severe soil compaction. Soil compaction reduces water infiltration. It reduces the ability of the soil to store water because there's less pore space. There's less space in there for it to actually hold water. And the reduction in infiltration and water storage increases surface runoff. Surface runoff increases soil erosion. Soil erosion, in turn, also tends to reduce infiltration and water storage because the less soil there is as it gets eroded, the less soil there is to store the water. And not only that, soil erosion occurs at the surface layers, which have the highest infiltration rates and usually the highest organic matter. Now, one of the reasons soil erosion is so critical is because it's non-reversible. Soils are built on the scale of thousands of years. So for all intents and purposes, when you erode soil and it's exported out of a watershed, that's a permanent loss. Same thing with the organic matter in the surface layers. One of the other impacts of logging is the loss of organic material. When you take wood out, and wood and trees are by far the largest source of organic matter, by far, in forested ecosystems, it can't decompose, it can't supply organic matter, that's a permanent loss. It's gone forever. It's gone someplace else. It's not going to be decomposing. The other thing is when you take trees out, that takes away the cover on the soil. Logging often kills ground vegetation, the native ground cover, exposes more soil. You have more erosion. The cycle continues. So that's with logging in general. When we get to roads and landings, and people leave out landings, I'll come back to them in a second, the impacts are extremely severe. They're non-reversible, and virtually every single one of the negative impacts that we talked about occurs. Severe soil compaction, complete removal of soil cover, vastly elevate soil erosion, and roads always accompany logging. If they're not constructed to facilitate logging for whatever reason, they take old roads and they reconstruct them or they build temporary roads, but there are, I can't think of a logging operation on public lands that isn't truly involved no new roads. They also involve landings. Landings are where they cart the trees to load them up onto the roads and take them off. People tend to forget about landings, but landings typically are about 2% of the area that's logged. And so when you crank through that, that means, for instance, if you had, about 5,000 acres of logging, you're looking, landings comprise, area-wise, about the same amount of area as 40 miles of road. That's a lot of road. And if there's one thing we know very well that's been extremely well documented, is that the roads have extremely, extremely negative impacts because of the severity of soil compaction, the complete loss of cover, the tremendous elevation and soil erosion, and also the hydrologic effects. And when we talk about soil erosion, they increase on a newly constructed road, you're looking at thousands of times higher than natural levels of erosion. So it's tremendous. If you're looking at how much infiltration is lost on a road or a landing, you're looking at 98%. It effectively almost zeros out the ability of soils to infiltrate water. And I think any of you who have spent time out on dirt roads and public lands know it doesn't take much of any rain before runoff starts to occur, and that's because there's such low infiltration. And that soil erosion doesn't just export soils. Again, causes severe water quality problems. Elevated sediment delivery is one of the most widespread water quality problems in the West, and it's certainly a big water quality problem for fisheries west-wide. In fact, if you look at fish that are listed or should be listed under the Endangered Species Act, virtually all of them are plagued by elevated sediment problems, largely linked to roads and logging. One of the other problems with roads is it doesn't look like they ever completely bounce back. That means even if you try to get rid of them and you go through a bunch of remediation activity, the data is not there to indicate that they ever fully recover. They probably do sometime way in the future, but research does indicate that they continue to have adverse impacts even 50 years after treatment. So it's a long, long time if you ever get to them. When we look at logging and going back to organic matter, available data is that, and this is for post-fire, dug it out, it's come out recently, the amount of wood that is taken away, total organic material from logged versus unlogged, is on the order of about 17 tons per acre. So that's a lot. That's a large source of organic matter, and that's a permanent loss because, you know, that's been carted away someplace else. Those soils can never get that organic matter from that wood. I'm going to back up. That's 171 tons. It's really high, 171 tons per acre. The assumption usually is for every 10 pounds of organic material, you end up with a pound of organic matter once it decomposes. So That's 17 tons per acre is how much organic matter is robbed ultimately from these soils when they are logged. And that is a huge amount of organic matter, and it's organic matter that they can never get back because it's gone. It's been exported from the watershed. So going down, Joel had asked me to address fuel reductions and the effectiveness of fuel reduction, because some of the logging and biomass activities are sometimes said to be an effort to reduce the severity of fire behavior. Fuel reductions don't stop fire. At best, they can only reduce its severity. So that's one thing to keep in mind. The second thing to keep in mind is when they do try to reduce fuels, which they're talking about trees, I kind of bothers me to think of them just as fuels or say that, because they are trees, and trees are part of an ecosystem. That's very transient. Trees grow back, bushes grow back, shrubs grow back. At best, the reduction in fuels lasts about 20 years. And more often, it's in the order of about 10 or 11 years. So the reason that transience is important is because if people try to reduce fuels under the idea that it's going to affect fire behavior, if fire doesn't occur while those fuels are reduced, it has no effect. Absolutely none. And even though people play it up and say that there's a huge amount of forest that burns every year, if you look at public lands, and again, this data is from the West, only about 0.5% on average of public lands burn at fairly high severity. So that's quite low. The chances, because people don't know where fire is going to occur, the chance that fire will affect these areas that have been treated for fuels within a 20-year window is really small. When we look at the forest types that have the most frequent fire and are the most likely to be affected by fire, when you still run through it, the probability of those areas being affected by high severity, what would otherwise be high severity fire, is about 3 to 6%. So it's very small. And what that means is, if you take a look at that in a landscape, on average, if you do fuel reductions, if one does fuel reductions on 100 acres, on average, about 3 acres might affect fire behavior, high severity fire. So you're always going to be incurring these costs, these ecological costs on the soil of doing to do these fire fuel reduction efforts on like 96 to 97% of the landscape, while you might only get some kind of ostensible benefit in reducing fire severity on 3 acres. That's on average. Now, one of the other things is high severity fire does not have universally negative impacts. That's also been overblown. In fact, when you look at recruiting organic matter to soils, almost nothing is better than fire, because it kills trees, the trees fall down, they nourish the soil, the forests grow back, and on the cycle goes. And it's the same thing for aquatic systems. There's no better way to recruit wood into streams, and they're vital for streams, than fires. Those agents of tree mortality, that's part of the natural cycle. That's part of why we have forests. I don't care where it is that you're interested in. If there's a forest that you really like, it's been burned to a crisp sometime in the past, and I mean to a crisp. But the cycle continues. Fire is not a negative impact, and it has great impacts for a bunch of different species. So it's not completely, doesn't completely have adverse effects. Now, in contrast, when we look at roads and soil compaction and those activities from, or those impacts from logging, those are 100% negative. Soil compaction does not have any beneficial ecosystem effects. Elevated erosion doesn't have any beneficial ecosystem effects. None. Roads are one of the biggest ecological problems in public lands nationwide. And when you look at the quote-unquote threat from these things, and the data is pretty easy to dig out, currently with the roads that exist on public lands, and again, this, I have the data from some western regions, roads affect about 10 times more of the area currently than is annually affected by high-severity fire. When you try and treat fuels, you're always increasing road impacts. They're a bigger problem than high-severity fire. They affect a much larger area. They're universally negative. They have no ecological benefits. So those are key issues. The other thing, as we've talked about, is how long it takes when you look at, for recovery to occur. When you're looking at soil compaction, that's 50 to 80 years at least for recovery to occur. When you're looking at huge amounts of organic matter, the sources being exported, that's a permanent loss. You're never going to recover the organic matter that would have come from that wood if it had been able to fall down, go to the soil, cover the soil, and create organic matter. Topsoil export from soil erosion, you're out of luck. It's irretrievable and irreversible. So those are the general basics, and I will open the rest up to questions.
Excellent. Well, thanks a lot, John. Hydrologist and principal at Planeta Azul for explaining some of the impacts of fuels reduction and other logging on forest soils and watersheds, and going to unmute you all so you can ask any questions if you have any. 1 second, please.
Hello, this is Denny.
So if you have a question, go ahead, just speak up, introduce yourself, and if you have some sort of organization you're affiliated with as well, please.
Hello, this is Denny Haldeman from Chattanooga, Tennessee. A couple of issues I'd like you to address is the incidence of roads causing more wildfires that are caused by humans because they have access to large swaths of forest land because of the roads. And the other issue would be the amount of soil carbon oxidation and how long we would expect for that carbon to be returned to the soil at the levels that it was before the logging.
Well, let me start off with the roads. There's only been a few studies that have been done, and they haven't directly addressed that. I can't remember the one study off the top of my head, but they did find that most of the ignitions occurred fairly close to roads. And that was a couple years back. It might have even been 10. So it wasn't direct, but lightning's unlikely to occur close to roads. So, the authors did conclude that human access was probably likely one of the reasons. Now, when you look at carbon that's tied up in the soil, I'm not sure what question you were asking, whether how long it's tied up in the soils or how long it takes.
The soil carbon is like a product of the soil itself. It's carbon that's been sequestered for hundreds to thousands
sure.
of years.
Absolutely.
A large percentage of that oxidizes when you do a clear cut. And soil disturbances like that. And so, you're talking about recovery time on roads. What would be the recovery time on soil carbon to pre-logging levels?
Yeah, that one I don't know, but I do know what you're talking about. And most of the research I've seen on that has been from Europe, but I don't know the recovery times. But they have pointed out, yes, that soil disturbance, you're losing carbon that's been sequestered in the soil. But I just don't know what the decomposition rate or the recovery time is. I imagine it would be long. Most of those are pretty long processes.
Yeah, one study I saw is that if you replace a native forest with a monoculture, the monoculture will only sequester about 30% of the carbon above the ground and in the soil than a native forest has.
Well, there's no question about that. And, in fact, that's one of the things that I probably didn't tie up well enough. But when you have all these impacts on the soil, you know, you lose these things for X amount of time, or in the case of, you know, trees being taken away, you lose that organic matter forever. But each time you run through that cycle, you have soils that have lower productivity. They're less able to hold water. They have less organic matter. They have less nutrients. They produce less forest biomass, and so when you run through that cycle, there's even less of it that falls to the floor. So you're on kind of a spiral that's going the wrong direction. And I don't want to be alarmist. I don't want to be alarmist and say it's nearly as bad as the Dust Bowl, but when you look at what happened in the Dust Bowl, which is considered to be properly one of the big ecological catastrophes on this continent, it was from all those things. It was from soil damage, and it was from loss of organic matter and loss of native vegetation. That's what caused, you know, coupled with drought, but that was the cause, and that was well studied, and that was, they had that figured out in the 30s.
I have a comment about the, are you through with issues? Because I have something to say about the first one, about the access.
Go ahead.
Okay, on the access to areas making fire, this is Rocky Smith from Denver, making areas that have road access have more fires. That's there's a pretty damn good statistical correlation with that. Look in the EIS for the Forest Service's roadless rule, came out in 2000 or 2001, and they found, if I remember correctly, again, just statistically, not looking at individual fires, but that fires, all fires that started, all human-caused fires, they were much more likely to start in an area that had road access. And if you think about it, that makes a lot of sense, because more people means more fires, even when they're not trying to start one by throwing a cigarette butt out the window. A big fire here in Colorado in 2002 started when a car having engine trouble pulled off into the into high grass, and the hot catalytic converter started a major fire. So keep that in mind.
Any other questions anyone wants to ask, John?
Yeah, this is Jan from Oregon. I'm afraid I called in late. I didn't catch John's full name and who he's with or what he represents.
It's John Rhodes. He's a hydrologist, and he's the principal at Planeta Azul.
He's where?
I hope I'm pronouncing that right.
We can't understand
yeah.
you.
John Rhodes, he's hydrologist and the principal at Planeta Azul.
Could you spell
Planeta
that?
Planeta Azul, as in blue?
Blue planet,
yeah.
Yep. Planeta, P-L-A-N-E-T-O-A-Z-U-L, and it's
okay.
hydrology. Yeah, it's a small, I just run a small consulting outfit.
Do you want to give them the website, John?
I could, but you know what? I don't remember it off the top of my head. I don't
think
it's their website.
I think it's
PlanetaAzul.com.
Correct. Yeah, that's what
yeah.
it is. Yep.
PlanetaAzul.com. Sorry
okay.
about that. I just don't look at the website.
So was somebody asking a question? Go ahead.
I have a question, or actually a comment. John, we often hear about, from people who are so afraid of a high-intensity fire and the damage that it's going to do. You know, and you know, you said you didn't want to be alarmist. Well, an awful lot of people are alarmist about that. And sometimes they'll talk about the soil damage from the, or what they consider to be soil damage from the very high intensity fire. Could you talk about that versus the damage from soils from the use of heavy equipment and logging?
Sure, I could. One of the main things, though, is that it has been documented in some places that there is soil damage from fires, but how much of that really occurs is really it's a matter of scientific debate. So, does it always occur? The answer is no. Does it usually occur? They don't know. We don't know. And when I say we don't know, there were some studies about 4 years ago, because typically what happens is they can't take data prior to the fires. They don't do that on what the soil properties were. They only take them afterwards, and then if it's low infiltration, they conclude that the fire caused soil damage. Some folks went throughout the West, and they found out that infiltration rates in some of these forest soils were actually lower than had been measured in burned areas where people thought there had been soil damage. So there's no real, it's not a real good notion. The other thing is there's many, many, many places, it doesn't get much press, but there's many places where there's extremely large fires and they have a pretty muted soil erosion response from the fires, where there's high severity fire and not much is made about it. And when they do have a few events in a few places, a lot is made about it. Now, when you look at roads, for instance, let me pull up that data because I think I do have it somewhere. I just got done mentioning roads. It's about a 98% loss of infiltration rate, and that's essentially permanent for as long as the roads exist. And when we look at, here it is, soils that are considered to be hydrophobic or damaged by fires, it's about a 50% reduction is kind of the average that occurs in infiltration rate. That's the best guess. And that's from several fires, and that usually only lasts a year, maybe two, sometimes three, but at the end of the third year, usually it's impossible to measure. So there's a very big difference there. The losses from other sources of compaction, as I said, compaction usually takes 50 to 80 years for full recovery, so you're looking at diminishment of infiltration rates and water storage over that period of time. And, of course, the surface effects of fire affect only the surface, so they don't actually affect water storage capacity of soil profile the way soil compaction or soil loss does.
Okay, good.
Hello?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
This is Loretta from Oregon. I also came in late, but I thought, yeah, this was going to be on hydrology and not so much on fires. But in regards to fires, I've been stewarding acreage that had been logged twice here in Oregon. And I would say the greatest risk of fire is are the invasive species, such as Scotch broom, that rampantly takes over the land after it's been logged. I did the fire reduction process and had done a lot of clearing, but that plant will literally burst into flames, has some oils in it perhaps. And also, as far as I've heard you talk mostly about public lands, 2/3 of Oregon is private lands through Weyerhaeuser and other logging giants who are rampantly logging close to the creeks. We only have two ODF field people that are getting out there and seeing what they're doing. Behind me, I planted trees on Mosby Creek, and they are taking every last tree they can with machine logging now. And the creek is the lowest I've ever seen in 28 years. We have the Forest Protection Act. It's more like the Weyerhaeuser Protection Act. We actually have no protection at all as far as stopping this criminal behavior. So my question, I guess, is adding to the conversation, the invasive species problem, and also the private logging, which is also a huge factor. And I think they're trying to race and try to cut every tree before there are any forest fires, is what I think their logic is, as well as top dollar with shipping out, exporting a lot of our forests. If you can speak to that. Thanks.
Well, yeah, there's the public lands that I brought up, that was just because I have data from it, but there's no question that there's a host of those activities that are going on private lands. They tend to be lower elevation. There's little question scientifically that the forest practices in Oregon is not adequate, even if it was enforced and implemented, is not adequate to protect aquatic systems, period. And how it addresses exotic or non-native vegetation is really not at all. And it is a big problem. It's a big problem on the west side, not only on private lands, but on public lands. And it is, it's a fundamental change in the ecology and fire ecology of those systems. And also, my experience is that you're absolutely right, is that the regulations on private lands are not enforced consistently. They're almost not even enforced.
Right.
So that's...
Well, I have a question that is sort of related to that. First of all, Scott's broom doesn't grow in a dense forest. So
no, it does not.
Logging
That's right.
causes,
realize...
logging is
yep.
actually the cause of the invasive species, but the invasive species is also a nitrogen-producing species, so it produces nitrogen for the soil, and I've seen improved tree growth, Douglas fir growth, for example, with an cover of Scott's broom until it dies out. However, my question has to do with just in general these new even-aged plantations, and what's the incidence of fire in those as opposed to, say, a closed canopy, for example, 100 years old? I mean, it seems to me the closed canopy is nice and damp on the floor, and right next to it is a 10-year-old plantation that, you know, it, the soil just, there's no duff. I mean, it's essentially kind of barren soil.
Yeah, the denser plantations do tend to burn hotter. I don't know that anybody has tracked, because it's a problem with private lands. There's no mechanism for collecting data or requiring data to be collected as far as fire severity goes. But since there is some of that data being collected, there's no question that on the plantations, which they're plantations from the 70s and 80s on public land, almost universally, when there is a fire, they almost universally burn at a much higher severity than older forests. Almost universally.
Right.
And it's for all the reasons you described. It's canopy conditions, it's density of vegetation, it's the understory. And I would also agree with you that until you get a healthy forest overstory, it's almost impossible to get rid of some of the other more undesirable vegetation like Scott's broom.
Right.
It
well,
does
what
go
they,
away. It does, it
what
go
they
away
do here in Oregon is they spray the hell out of it until...
Unfortunately, that is correct.
Yeah.
Yes, they do. And it's problematic, and it has real problems for stream systems, soil systems, and the rest. Yep.
Yeah, every living thing.
Yep,
right.
Every living, that's correct.
And not to mention monoculture, which the deciduous trees have been taken out of the succession, which is what builds all the humus in the soil to retain the moisture, et cetera. So that's another factor leading to more severe fires, a monoculturally inferior tree farm.
Absolutely.
Hi, my name is Allie Melton. I work with High Country Conservation Advocates out of Crested Butte, Colorado. I have a few questions that are kind of interrelated, and it kind of brings us back to that discussion of growth and kind of the high-severity fire.
Right.
I don't know if it's best for me to just start with one and then go to the other ones that I have.
Well, let's try.
Okay. The forest that I work in is spruce fir subalpine. So I was wondering how much of the science that you've cited so far is relevant to those type of forests.
Well, I haven't split it out by forest type, but there's a general agreement. When you look at this goes, I don't know whether you're talking about fire or talking about road density or soils, But if we're talking about fire, there's general agreement that the upper elevation forests are not burning any differently, and that fuels have not really been the issue. Fire and those kind of forests are climate driven. When it gets dry, they burn, and when they burn at high severity, and that's generally been the way fire behaves in those forests.
And then for roads and soil, is it pretty similar as well, or does that get more site specific at all, depending on forest cover type?
No, the roads would have the same impacts, same time frame. The recovery from compaction tends to be even a little bit slower in those systems due to the lack of organic matter and the fact that regrowth tends to be a little bit slower.
Okay, that was really helpful. A narrative that we've been hearing a lot is that high-intense fires destroy the seed sources. And so after there's a high-intense fire, we lose the forest completely. Which seems totally wrong. I'm not a scientist, though, so I don't have any science to throw at people. I was wondering if maybe you could talk about that a little bit.
Well, if we're talking about the high-elevation subalpine forests, those forests have co-evolved with fire. They primarily burn at high severity. And so those are, even some of those species are the species that the cones famously kind of in forest ecology, they actually open up after they've been burned at high severity. So the only objections, or not objections, but the only line of thinking I've heard along that line is not from subalpine, but from lower elevation forests, that the seed sources might be consumed. But again, those forests burn and they come back.
When you refer to lower elevation, what kind of range is that specifically?
Well, it depends on where you are, but that would be like more like ponderosa pine type forests.
Okay.
It's all relative, but basically lower elevation, we're talking about ponderosa, mainly ponderosa pine or ponderosa pine dominant forests at lower elevation. The middle elevation tends to be mixed conifers, and then subalpines, lodgepole, spruce, et cetera.
Okay. Another thing that people have been raising is that when we have these high intense fires, it has extreme negative impact on our watersheds, and people are trying to justify a watershed timber salvage sale to reduce water storage impacts or impact on streams. Is there anything that you could talk about to that extent?
Well, it's the same thing we've kind of covered in the talk. There is damage to watersheds that's caused by those, which includes roads and the rest of that, roads, landings, loss of organic matter, which are watershed impacts, and those are virtually assured, but the return on them is, the chance that those fuel reduction efforts might affect fire is pretty slim. So the trade-offs are not particularly good.
And I have one last one. A lot of people have been talking about, there's no value for dead trees, which is not true. And I've really liked hearing kind of the narrative talking about how, obviously trees are part of the life cycle and return nutrients back to the soil. They also provide important wildlife habitat. Are there additional values beyond those things that I should be sure to add to my list of points?
No, those would be the basic ones. They're all, you know, they're also an important source of cover, soil cover. And then the other thing is that down trees, you can even go look at this after a fire, and it does, you know, vary depending on where you're at. But down trees don't tend to burn very severely. They, you know, they're in touch with the ground. They tend to be moister and all the rest of that stuff. So it's not the downed wood that causes fires or contributes significantly to fires.
Thanks. That was it. I appreciate it.
Yeah. You know, I'm a hydrologist. I've been doing this for 30 years. I've been knocking around private lands and public land forests for a long time. But I will tell you that after all that, and not being trained to look at that, the big difference that always, always strikes me, and I think anybody can see that, if you go into a healthy, unmanaged forest, what you find is, I'm talking about healthy, a good, healthy forest that hasn't been beat up, there's lots of wood on the ground. When you go into commercial land that's been through a couple cycles, there's not. And I'm talking about, you know, big pieces of wood. There's not.
Right.
There's not a lot of wood on the floor. It's gone. Many times, you know, private lands, pretty common that after they got done clear cutting them, then they burned it. They don't do that all the time now, but it's a very, very striking difference, and it's a striking difference that has is of great ecological importance, and it certainly is, you know, it's huge for habitat. And that's one of the other things, too, is that when you look at, you know, that's one of the things, the benefits of fire, they've known for a long time that heterogeneity in forests is good for wildlife, and there's nothing that can create a lot of heterogeneity at the landscape scale. Fire's great for that. And early seral states, that's what scientists are now calling post-fire landscapes, are great for wildlife. One of the big ones that was considered to be a disaster, it's not what I do, but one of the ones that was considered to be a disaster was the Cerro Grande fire there in New Mexico near the Four Corners area. Burned in 2003. They went back in 2008 and found some of the highest bird diversity that they could find in the entire Southwest 5 years after fire.
Mm.
That's not catastrophic.
I have a question that's kind of oblique from what we've been discussing, but one of my pet peeves are forestry schools, you know, that taught a lot of these practices that we're trying to change. Do you have any insight into our forestry schools changing at all?
Well, I mean, I do agree with you that it's a problem. I don't know that it's particular to forestry schools, but I think what happened with education is that and science, the field of science, they tended to look at these things very mechanistically instead of holistically. And when I say mechanistically, if they don't know what something's good for, then maybe it's not good for anything. You can cart it away. So that's been a real problem. And another real problem is that there's almost seems to be a fear of letting natural processes operate. And if we don't fully understand what those natural processes are doing or how they operate, it's kind of we've become a society where we see something that works in practice and then wonder if we can change it in theory and have decent results. But yeah, it is a real problem.
I have something.
I think one of the biggest educational things that I see is, you know, on the fire front. Fire is a really important natural process. It does a lot of different things in these forests, and I'm not even going to try and list them all. It does a lot of different things that are really highly beneficial. All these forests, coast to coast, they've co-evolved with fire. Fire is an important process. We can't try to squash it, control it, and then use it as an excuse to try and create commodities.
I have a question which I've been trying to ask for a long time on this call. This is Bob Paulser. I live in Ashland, Oregon. We have the Ashland Watershed, which is primarily rogue national forest, and we are doing absolutely the opposite thing to retain organic matter or to reduce fire hazards, et cetera. How can one deal and change the course of things when the Forest Service and a lot of other organizations have bought in to the lies that the land managers are giving?
Well, I'm not completely sure, except that I would suggest you just kind of have to stay at them, which is not a satisfactory answer, but things take time.
Yeah, this is...
Is there more... I believe your numbers, but are there more sources and some of the specifics on forest frequency intervals and the damage to the soils by compaction and so forth that I could point people to?
There is a slew of them. I will try and send some of them to, I guess, to Josh. Maybe we can take it from there. But yeah,
we also do have a lot of studies up on energyjustice.net/biomass. There's a lot of studies relevant to forest, wildfire, soil, watershed issues there.
This is Craig calling in. I missed the first part. I apologize, so I'm not sure if you went over this, but two points that I would like to make, and one is that I find it very disappointing that so many people who talk about fire do not differentiate between the beneficial surface fire and the cataclysmic fire that goes up the fire ladder into the crowns and becomes unstoppable. And particularly as it's germane to the fact that we've cut all the big trees and replaced them with plantations, which I believe makes us far more at risk for cataclysmic fire, because you can't have a surface fire in a plantation. All of the lands that we've created that are basically uniform will only have one kind of fire. And when I've asked the forest researchers how much separation you would need between the forest floor and the lower branches within a plantation in order to potentially support a beneficial surface fire, they say, great question, but we haven't asked it. So I think that the fact that so much of our management is truly far more at cause of the predicament that we're in with cataclysmic fire gets very little airtime, and I don't understand that. The second point is that we did a tour here up in McKenzie Bridge where I live relative to the Goose Project, and this week on Tuesday, and they were taking us to some units that they say are more fire safe, where they've done some thinning and some underburn, and frankly, it looked terrible. There was more fuel load on the forest floor, from my perspective, after their treatment than before, and there's less canopy to provide shade, so that fuel load is going to get drier and more potentially flammable for a forest fire, and yet they're telling us that that's making us more fire safe. What do we need to do in order to get them to have some common sense?
I don't think they ever have any. It's going to be pretty hard to inject them with some.
Embarrass them in front of God and everybody with reality.
Yeah. Give them science. Give them common sense. From what you described, it sounds like there's an awful lot they're doing wrong just intuitively without going into any big science, but then cite them some science and show that they're wrong.
It was so ludicrous. They even had a bunch of trees where they did a broadcast burn that had significantly burned these trees and the bark. There was one tree that the inner Cambrian layer was exposed, and they were trying to say, oh, it's okay, those trees will survive. Baloney. Baloney, they'll survive. They're damaged. There'll be insects in there. There'll be, you know, it's another form of clear cutting in stages, just like their so-called restoration harvests, you know, or shelter wood harvests. It's baloney.
See, Craig, you don't understand. We know better than nature.
Well, that's what
and
I kept saying.
These guys wouldn't have a job if they just let nature take its course.
And that's what I kept saying to them. How in the world did nature get along without our management for
exactly.
all these millennium?
We saved the forest. Remember
so
that.
So we have about time for one more question, if anyone wants to go ahead and ask John. Before we're going to try to conclude around 3 o'clock.
If I can, I'd like to add something to the educational piece, unless somebody has another pressing question, because I've already spoken.
Do we have anyone else who hasn't spoken yet? But if somebody else who hasn't spoken yet has a question, go ahead. After the call, if people want to stick around and still have a conversation, they're certainly welcome to. But has anyone who has not spoken yet have a question for John? Well, I would say go ahead. Was it Loretta? If you have a comment, go ahead.
Just kind of a positive note. As far as universities, up at OSU here in Oregon, they've actually are open, being very much funded by timber industries, are open to agricultural industrial hemp. There's a curriculum available through a woman, Andrea Herman, who resides in Canada. She was actually from Missouri, was given an $84,000 scholarship to set up the hemp industry in Canada. Europe is leading the way with construction materials, Canada with oil, China with fiber. We've just gotten our first license to grow it here next year. Colorado and Kentucky are already growing it. A house can be built on 2.5 acres in 4 months for a 1,250-square-foot home, which is superior with mildew, mold resistance, and energy efficiency compared to using wooden materials. Because that's always the bottom line is you just can't stop something. You have to replace it with something else. It's not going to be the answer for everything, but I see this as a promising note to take the demand off of deforestation here in Oregon.
Well, excellent
and,
point.
There is also a free online course for seniors that are over 65 years old through the OSU, and it costs $800 for 3 credits for not being a senior. But there's a lot of really exciting momentum taking place after 70 years of prohibition and the updates and potential of an annual crop replacing our decade-grown ecosystems, our forests that are our major carbon sequestration carbon sinks. So I'm really excited that OSU is actually open to hosting this curriculum.
And that's certainly some good news. Thanks for that, Loretta. And we'll conclude with that. I want to offer thanks again to our guest speaker, John Rhodes, hydrologist and the principal at Planeta Azul. You can go to planetoazul.com. And thanks to everyone who made it on this Biomass Truth conference call. The May topic will be on media bias in regards to biomass energy. And if you want to get a notice of future calls or the link to the recording for this one, you can go to thebiomassmonitor.org or you can email me, Josh Schlossberg, at thebiomassmonitor@gmail.com. So thanks, everyone.
Thank you, Josh.
Thank you, Josh.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.